Welcome to New Books in Film. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today I'll be speaking with Dennis Bartok and Jeff Joseph, authors of the book, A Thousand Cuts, Film Collectors in the Digital Age, published in 2016 by University Press of Mississippi. Dennis and Jeff traced the story of movie fans who collect actual celluloid film. While the idea may seem innocuous, many of these collectors dealt with legal issues and other forms of intimidation. The authors interviewed both well-known and lesser-known collectors who reviewed their experiences. Welcome to Dennis Bartok and Jeff Joseph. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Joel.
And Jeff, you there too?
Hi, Joel. Yes, I am.
Great. Yeah, I don't always interview two people at the same time, although one famous time I had six people on at one time, and I still can't believe I had that technology, the technologically down, but we did it. Anyway, it's great to talk to you both. Most of the time when I talk to authors, it's about a movie, a specific genre of movie, or a specific artist, like a director or a writer or an actor. Your book's a little different because it's about film, but it's about physical film. It's the real thing now we're talking about, and the whole idea of collectors. We know of people who collect Hollywood memorabilia and that kind of thing, but what you folks are talked about in your book, though, is the collection of the actual films. And I found it all very interesting, especially some of the copyright things you talked about. So I'm really looking forward to getting some of the background. But before we go too far, let me learn a little bit more about each of you. Dennis, why don't you tell me your background and sort of what led you to where you are today?
Well, right now I'm the general manager at the American Cinematheque, which is a nonprofit based in Los Angeles that runs the 1922 era Egyptian theater on Hollywood Boulevard and the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica. I'm also senior acquisitions executive for Cinelicious Picks, which is an art house distributor. We recently released 1973 Japanese animated film called Belladonna of Sadness. Did a 4K restoration, which will be out on Blu-ray soon, of a lost Leslie Stevens directed noir called Private Property, which had Warren Oates in his first film role. I've worked as a screenwriter, as a director. I was head of programming here at the American Cinematheque for a long time, from 1992 to 2005, which is how I met Jeff Joseph and a number of the other film collectors and film dealers that are profiled in A Thousand Cuts. Because I would reach out to them often for technical advice or if I was trying to locate a rare or unusual film print. And in Jeff's case, we organized several different film series together. We did a couple Dye Transfer Technicolor festivals as well as a four-track mag series. And he loaned a number of prints or gave me print sources over the years. So that's my background. And Jeff, you can jump in.
Yeah, I was kind of messing with film since I was, 10 or 11 years old, running movies in my garage for the neighborhood kids. And I sold the company, Sabucat, in 2009, but the last 5 or 6 years now, I've been working with the UCLA Archive and the Library of Congress, restoring and preserving the Laurel and Hardy Hal Roach Film Library. And the goal is to put them in theaters, and that's what we've been doing. This last year, we've had various theatrical screenings, and we've got one coming up in November at the Film Forum on November 27th. In New York.
Well, given my age, I would have to tell you that the Hal Roach and the Laurel and Hardys is very much a part of my childhood. Of course, not in the theaters, at home on television, Saturday mornings.
Well, that's true. I mean, I grew up watching them on TV also. I mean, I think we baby boomers did that. And that's how I fell in love with the movies, was watching Laurel and Hardy and then finding out later that I could actually own physical 16mm prints of them was incredible. Blackhawk Films was selling Laurel and Hardy to the public. Never occurred to me in my wildest dreams that someday I'd be working on the original elements and restoring them, but it's been an absolute blast and an honor to be doing it.
Well, ironically, it's one of the things that Leonard Maltin points out in his chapter in our book, is that the way that many film collectors first got exposed to the movies and fell in love with film was through television. Because in the 1950s and 1960s, old movies were cheap programming for television. they needed to fill lots of airtime, and so you would see, you know, the million-dollar movie, and they would run King Kong or Casablanca or Singing in the Rain. I mean, of course, a lot of the color films were shown in black and white, and as Joe Dante points out, they would in his chapter, they would often edit the films to fit into a shorter time slot. So he said,
True. Local Channel 7 here used to run Singing in the Rain in a 90-minute time slot with most of the musical numbers cut out.
Yeah, or Joe comments that when he saw King Kong growing up, it always started when they got to Skull Island. He would never see most of the first act of the movie. They would just, you know, start it, and they were already on the island, you know, with the drums and the huge wall and Kong.
That's sort of like starting the 1978 Superman with the moment he reaches the Daily Planet. Cut out the whole first 45 minutes, and what the heck? You haven't lost any story. You're just going right on.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
So, yeah, because I'm the same way. I mean, when I was growing up, it was the, you know, like you say, the million-dollar movie, and that was exactly what it was called. Everybody had their own. I lived in Cleveland, Ohio. So we had Captain Penny around noon who would show Little Rascals, or obviously our gang, and other things, and that's where you started to see some of these things. And then we actually had a few of the 8mm Castle film versions of some of these films like you talk about in the book, and so that's why I found the whole thing. The book just reached out to me. It's interesting you mentioned Leonard Maltin. The interview I just did last week, which isn't going to be published for another month or so because the book's not coming out yet, he did the foreword for that book. So I've got two in a row with a Leonard Maltin collection, so that's a good thing.
Oh, that's great. Well, the other connection, of course, with TV and film collecting is that television was actually the source for tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of mostly 16mm prints, which eventually made their way into the private collector market. Because before the advent of videotape, the way that everybody saw TV, whether it was a feature film or whether it was a TV episode, a rerun of Gilligan's Island or F-Troop, was off of 16mm prints. And those prints were often sold by the studios or the networks to the stations, and then they were run. And when they were finished, they would either sell them to a salvage company, you know, who would recycle them, or in many cases, you know, sell them directly to collectors. So that was actually the way that many 16mm prints wound up in private hands, is after they had kind of finished their life in television.
I think that's especially true in the 1980s, as the TV stations were switching to videotape. They were dumping thousands of prints. I mean, it was just an incredible amount of film. We were getting 40-foot truckload full of film in like once a month. It was incredible.
Well, so setting that up, then what we're talking about, if it isn't clear so far. When you talk about 1,000 cuts, we're talking about films, the actual film stock, as it was usually being shown in the theaters, or in this case on television, where collectors would be collecting the actual films in the same way nowadays we would collect DVDs or videotapes and, you know, VHS in the past. These are people who were collecting, and I still do to an extent, the actual prints that were used in theaters after, as you pointed out, they were given away to salvage companies usually, or some other formats, or from other collectors.
Yeah, bear in mind that it was a time period before home video, so if you wanted to see Casablanca, the only way to see it was like a 16mm print, or, you know, perhaps at 3 o'clock in the morning on Channel 5, or perhaps if you lived in a big enough city, a revival theater that might run it now and then. But mostly, if you wanted to see a movie, you couldn't. Whereas if you had a 16mm print, you could pull it out any time and run it.
Our book is really about the death of film, the physical film medium, and it's also about the death of the collectors. And there's a perfect storm that is happening right now, which was the urgency for us to write the book. And it's kind of underscored by the fact that I think six or seven of the people who are profiled in the book have sadly passed away since we started work on it 5 years ago. The films themselves are slowly decaying. You know, all film will eventually decay. It is not a stable medium. It continues to essentially develop itself, no matter how well made it is. And even if you store it under ideal conditions, it will eventually break down. And a lot of the prints that were made in past decades have already broken down. Jeff, you can explain it better. They essentially produce acetic acid, which gives off a vinegar smell and has given rise to the term vinegar syndrome or film rot.
Yeah, all plastic decomposes over time. It's a natural process, but acetate film does decompose, and one of its things is acetic acid, and so that's vinegar, basically, and so film starts to smell like vinegar. That's why it's called vinegar disease, another form of VD, you might say. And all film, that will happen to all film over time. I mean, what happens is currently, though, is the heat and humidity, you know, bad storage, bad processing, that sort of thing, accelerates a natural process that's happening anyway. Whereas if you keep film cool and dry, you know, properly taken care of, it will last hundreds of years, but eventually it will go vinegar too, unfortunately. It's a fragile medium.
Yeah, so all of the prints are either fading and or breaking down, and that's something that you just can't stop. They're not making any more new prints for the most part, except in rare instances for archival presentations. The studios have pretty much gotten out of the business of distributing or striking new 35mm and 16mm films. They're still making film stock. There's a handful of directors out there, whether it's Quentin Tarantino or J.J. Abrams, Christopher Nolan, who still want to shoot on film, and so companies like Kodak are still making film stock available, but for the most part, you know, the studios have completely divorced themselves from distributing movies. So we're not going to have any more new prints out there. So pretty much, the prints that are in existence right now. The collectors themselves are aging. You know, most of those who were active in, you know, the 1970s or 80s, which were the kind of glory years for film collecting, they're now reaching or have reached retirement age. They're dealing with, you know, just normal problems of aging. So, you know, they're facing their own mortality, and there isn't a younger generation that is really out there to carry on this passion, because you can now get access to film in so many different ways. You can stream it. You can see it on Blu-ray. You can see it on DVD. And so the collectors that grew up, you know, in that post-World War II baby boom generation, they had a relationship to the movies, a kind of passion for film that I don't think we'll ever see again. And the collector subculture was almost like a hidden priesthood devoted to the movies. And, you know, many of them would build their own screening rooms in their basement or in their homes that were like their little temples of movie worship. And as the collectors are dying out, we're losing those little kind of private film museums or cinema worlds that are a particularly fascinating, almost architectural part of Los Angeles. And, you know, Jeff, maybe you can talk about Ken Kramer, whose office/archive museum, the Clip Joint, was one of the most remarkable little temples of movie obsession. And you had known Ken for many years, and he just passed away, sadly, a few months ago. And I don't know, maybe you want to describe the Clip Joint and what it was like.
The Clip Joint was a place, as you say, with posters all over the place, film props, but mostly films, 35 and 16 millimeter films. Pretty much anywhere you try to sit, there was a film. Pretty much any time you tried to walk anywhere, there was a film in your way. An awful lot of film. But Ken at least looked at his film. He ran film all the time. And he loved film very much, and he would invite people over to see it and share it with them. Some collectors did and don't. I mean, there's certainly collectors I've known who collect things and never run them. It's kind of amazing that you'd spend all that money and never run it, but there are collectors who do just that.
You know, there are people who collect toys and never open them, so.
I suppose.
Well, another one of the collectors that we interviewed for the book, Matt Spiro, is a retired former projectionist, and he lives with his partner in Hollywood, and he's built this beautiful miniature movie palace in their home, and he's decorated it with bits and pieces that he salvaged from old movie palaces that were being torn down in Long Beach. And he would be driving around, and he would see them starting to demolish one of these great movie palaces, and he would stop his car, and he would run in, and he would say, you know, can I have those seats, or can I have that wall sconce? And so his house has this beautiful little jewel box theater that maybe seats 25 people, but in it are the ghosts, the bones of all these great long-gone movie palaces. And now the sad thing is that Matt and his partner are having to move, and so their little miniature jewel box theater will soon be gone as well. And he says, you know, that he's going to try and rebuild it in their new home out in the desert. But, you know, he's already, I think Matt is in his early 70s. And so, you know, he's not a young man, and he doesn't even project film, you know, at home himself anymore. So the chances that he's really going to go to all the trouble of rebuilding this movie theater are, you know, probably fairly slim. So that's going to disappear soon. And again, that's part of the cultural history of Los Angeles that very few people know about. And it's a really fascinating
world. I wouldn't say just Los Angeles. I mean, there's people all over the country with these little theaters in their life, don't you think?
Yeah, that's true. There was a very active East Coast scene. There were actually film collecting and dealing scenes that kind of grew up around major distribution centers. And Jeff, you knew about this, but there was one in Kansas City, in the Midwest. I mean, you know, so wherever the studios had kind of distribution depots, that was an opportunity for prints to slip out into the collector market.
Yeah, there used to be a company called National Film Service that handled most of the 35mm theatrical distribution for all the studios. And each major city, each area of the country had their own depot where they stored 35mm prints. Now, mind you, they went out of business in the 90s, and now, you know, Technicolor and Deluxe, I believe, do the distribution themselves. But back in the day, these distribution places were all over the country, owned by individual people, and most of them, a good number of them anyway, had people selling prints out the back door to film collectors. They were told by the studios, you know, junk all your prints of, you know, movie XYZ. And yeah, most of them would go in the dumper, but a few would make their way out to film collectors at maybe $50 a pop.
So basically, what we're talking about, and I'm sure everything's clear, but in case there's somebody who might be listening and who might not understand this completely, these days most movies are not projected from projectors anymore. We don't use 35mm film print or film stock or any kind of film stock anymore. Everything's done digitally, and it's projected digitally. So
it's
that's
the equivalent of it's the equivalent of what you have at home for a video projector, only it's a professional version of that, essentially.
Right. Films, if you go to a movie theater, the way that you're seeing a film projected is generally through like a 4K digital projector in the projection booth. And they're distributed now on what's called a DCP, which stands for Digital Cinema Package, and is essentially a portable hard drive that the studios send to the movie theater. You download it or ingest it onto a server where it's held. They send a security key to the theater, which is called a KDM, that allows you to unlock the film for X number of screenings, and then it locks it again. This is to prevent piracy, which is, as we detail in the book, was a major concern for the studios and the MPAA for many decades now. So, you know, if you're trying to collect film now, I guess you could have a collection of DCPs, I don't think it has the same romance. It's essentially, it would be like having a collection of portable hard drives. And the other issue is that, you know, in 5 or 10 years, who knows, the standards may change. So you might not even be able to play those DCPs in the same way 5 or 10 years from now.
You can't play them now. You can't play them now because without a KDM, you can't play them. Without the key, you can't play them. So, and to the best of my knowledge, nobody's hacked DCPs. Maybe they have it. I just don't know it. But basically, if you have a theatrical DCP, unless you have the key, it's just a brick. And to the best of my knowledge, not that many collectors collect DCPs for that reason. They're pretty useless unless you have the key.
Well,
yeah. So there really is no collecting market for the way the films are distributed now. So 35mm, 16mm film has been around for a long time in terms of the kind of life of media formats. It was extremely simple and very stable. I mean, they developed it in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and was in use as the main commercial format, 35mm, until the past 10 or 15 years. But when it was phased out, it happened at first slowly, but then very, very rapidly. So really, the past 4 to 5 years, we've seen almost all major commercial chains get rid of their 35mm projection. And one of the dealers, Steve Newton, that we interviewed for the book, sent us these really heartbreaking photos of dumpsters outside of his office filled with junked 35mm and 16mm projectors. And more than anything else, that just, picture says 1,000 words, that talks very eloquently about what's happening. And projectionists, we have a whole chapter, and in fact, the chapter is called 1,000 Cuts, which gave its name to the book itself. And film projectionists are one of the most endangered careers in America because they really don't need them anymore, apart from a handful of places, cinematechs and film museums like the American Cinematheque, UCLA Film Archive, the Academy of Motion Pictures, Museum of Modern Art, places like that still screen 35mm, 70mm, 16mm, as well as digital. But for most commercial theater chains, you could be an assistant manager, you could be the person who sells popcorn, and you could plug the DCP in and download it onto the server and push play. You don't really need any extensive training to project a film anymore.
Plus, I think a lot of these theaters are doing everything 100% automated. There isn't even anybody up in the booth, so to speak. It just does everything on its own.
Yep, that's right. So the job of projectionist, there's actually a series of technological changes which made the job of projectionist endangered and now essentially extinct. Is the first was when they changed over from carbon arc projection to xenon bulbs. And carbon arc, they used to have two carbon rods that would run electric current between them and would create this blinding light that was actually used to project the film. And when they switched over from the carbon arcs to xenon bulbs, that was a major change because those carbon rods burned down very quickly. You had to replace them about every 40 to 60 minutes. So that meant that you needed to have a projectionist there who was constantly switching those carbon rods out and maintaining the projectors. So first when you went to xenon, you needed fewer projectionists. Then when you went to the platter system, which was essentially it was almost like an 8-track tape for film, you'd build up an entire print onto these big metal platters that would run it continuously in a loop and then rewind it onto the big spool. So that allowed for multiplexes where now you could have one projectionist who would be running 4, 6, 8, 10, or 12 screens.
Worse than that, you could take one 35mm print and run it through several different screening rooms at the same time. You could go up in the booth and you could see this film winding all over the entire booth. That was, it would run for the first projector, then the second projector, then the third projector. It would be incredible wear and tear on these prints that were never designed for that.
Well, that's part of the thing I remember is going to see a popular film multiple times, and as time went on, that print would get more and more damaged, and although occasionally they would strike new prints, generally speaking, in fact, when we had what were, the second run and third run theaters, if you went to see a movie in a third run theater, the 99-cent theater, the chances are good that print was going to be in pretty bad shape.
true. But at least then, when you were still running film, you still needed a projectionist.
Right.
You still needed somebody with some skill who would get the print from, the octagonal Goldberg cans and build it up onto the platter, and then when the run of the film was over, they would break it down again, send it on to the next theater or back to the distributor. But now that we've transitioned from film into digital, you don't really need projectionists, again, apart from a few cinematheques. So that's part of the collateral damage that the transition from analog film to digital has been responsible for. And one of the most fascinating kind of thoughtful interviews that we did in the book was with a collector named Ronnie James, who has what is arguably the largest private collection of television prints anywhere in the world. And these are prints of old TV episodes, of rare kinescopes. A lot of the things that Ronnie has in his collections are one-of-a-kind items. Right. He has the only copy of it anywhere in existence. And he's extremely depressed now because he has this enormous collection and he feels it's of no financial or cultural value anymore. So he sits in his house in Orange County surrounded by, his 20,000 reels of film, and the phone doesn't ring. So he used to be able to license footage from these things for documentaries on classic Hollywood celebrities. Nobody really wants that anymore. They don't make those kind of documentaries. They're, if it's A&E bio, it's going to be on somebody like a more recent celebrity, Britney Spears or Justin Bieber. They don't need to go to guys like Ronnie to get footage on Fred Astaire or Bing Crosby or Gene Kelly. And so, his collection is incredibly imperiled. And one of the things he talks about is the theory of creative destruction, which was first proposed by a writer named Joseph Schumpeter in the mid-1940s. And it says that as technology changes, not only does it supplant or replace the old technology, but it can wipe out the way of life that was associated with it. And Ronnie likens it to the end of whaling in the 19th century when the electric light came in. So not only did it spell the end of commercial hunting of whales, which was a good thing, but it wiped out all of the towns and the way of life in New England that was associated with that. And we're seeing a similar thing now with the change from analog film to digital. And I think where you see it most acutely is that it's wiped out this small but incredibly fascinating and passionate subculture of film collectors and film dealers. And that was really the most compelling reason for Jeff and I to write the book, because if we don't interview these collectors now and if we don't document it in 5 years and 10 years, it won't be there, and that's the truth. We've already seen it. It's essentially died in front of our eyes. It's disappeared. There are a few younger collectors who are out there who are still buying 16mm and 35mm prints, but it's a pale version of, it's barely a shadow of what that subculture was in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. That when Jeff was
not to mention the few younger collectors that are out there, they tend to want to see prints of things they grew up with. They want The Matrix. They want Star Wars. They don't really care about Casablanca or The Big Sleep,
So let's go back a little bit to the beginning of the book itself, where some of the legal, because you open the book, or you start very early on in the book with discussing the legal issues of owning this material back in the day, so to speak. This was prior to home video, and therefore this was before any of the court cases that changed the whole, like I say, when home video first started, as you point out in the book, the studios had wanted no video recorders. They only wanted video players in the house so people could not record anything. That was the court case, and it was they claimed to protect their copyright. But talk a little bit about the legal cases that sort of pointed out some of the other negatives of being a collector of film.
The studio's point of view was always that they had never sold prints to the public, therefore anything that a collector had must have been obtained illegally, and therefore they should be arrested and you know, their collection seized and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, that wasn't really true. The studios, in fact, had sold prints to various entities, collectors, the military, the airlines, movie stars would be able to buy prints of their movies, that sort of thing. So there were actually legal sales. And once there's legal sales, there's the first sale doctrine, whereas once you buy something, you don't own the copyright to it. No, but you can sell it, like you would a used book, for example.
Right.
And but you know, from the studio point of view, they kind of hated collectors until about the 80s. Then they don't really care about collectors anymore because they have more important things to worry about, which is video piracy, which, you know, film collectors don't care about at all. They're not into video.
Yeah, because I remember, you know, I obviously, like I say, our family was probably one of the first people to buy a video recorder, and I remember that was back in the day where they had conflicting formats, and you had VHS and Betamax, and there was a that was still going on, and then of course there was the court cases, because as you point out, but then you've got the example of the person who actually won his case in, you know, at the first level, only to see it thrown out on a higher level. If he had won,
the studios always had money to spend on legal things. Collectors rarely did.
And unfortunately, it ruined him. I mean, he basically put him out of the collecting because he couldn't have, you know, he knew he had lost and he could not continue on with a legal fight.
Yeah, that was Evan H. Foreman, and I'm really glad that we were able to talk to him. He's sadly one of the former jailers who passed away in the past 2 years, but we were able to interview him for the book, and he was a fairly small-time film dealer based in Mobile, Alabama. And what he was doing was reconditioning used 16mm prints. He was essentially fixing them up, you know, fixing the torn splices, cleaning the prints, and then he would resell them to collectors for anywhere from, I think, you know, $50 or $60 for a fairly low-end beat-up print to maybe $150 on the high end. But the studios decided to make an example out of him, and so in the first major civil case, they filed suit against him in 1971. And what was amazing about Evan's case is that he decided to fight it, not only in court, but kind of using his own catalog to alert other collectors and dealers about what was happening. And he was really prescient, you know, because his case happened about 3 years before the much more publicized sort of, you know, film raids or film busts of 1974, 1975, including the arrest of actor Roddy McDowell and the seizure of his collection of film and video. And McDowell was by far the best known collector who was targeted in the FBI and Justice Department raids, and of course, this was right around the time where Jeff was indicted as well, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that experience, what, you know, why it came about and what happened.
Yeah, I had only sent out one film list, I think, in my life at that point, but it had been acquired by the FBI when they raided somebody else, so they had my name. And they came to the door one day with a search warrant for the garage and for the storage unit. They took all the film. They asked me to sign a release, which I did not sign. I guess some people do. And then I was indicted at federal court a few months later. When I went down to court, I met my other defendants. Most of them I had never met until that day. That's what a small-time dealer I was. I didn't even know these people. It was an interesting time for sure. I mean, almost nobody fought it because we couldn't afford to fight it. We didn't have any money. Most of us pled guilty to single misdemeanor counts of copyright infringement, and that was the end of it because we couldn't afford to fight. Even though legally we probably were in the right, it didn't really matter. It was way too expensive to fight it.
And what Jeff, you were convicted for was you were actually selling prints to dealers in South Africa. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, the original indictment for me was several counts of copyright infringement, and one count of dealing stolen property, which was a felony, that was dropped. And then I pled guilty to a random misdemeanor, which happened to be 10 prints of the TV show It Takes a Thief, which I thought was kind of appropriate in many ways. But that was totally random. And the deal was supposed to be we all got 6 months suspended sentences. Unfortunately, each defendant had a different judge. My judge was an appointee of Nixon's who did not believe in suspended sentences. And it turns out in the federal court system, the judge does not necessarily have to go along with what the lawyers agree on. And so I was expecting to go home that day. I didn't even say goodbye to my wife. I just went down to court, assuming I'd come home, and instead he didn't say suspended sentence after 6 months. They hauled me away in handcuffs. It was an interesting day.
Well, there was a tremendous black market that grew up because at the time in the early to mid-70s, there was a cultural embargo where the major studios and TV networks weren't making their films and TV shows available to South Africa because of apartheid. And so this black market grew up where Jeff and other dealers were selling films and TV shows over there, and hundreds of film rental shops sprang up in South Africa, and they were precursors to like video rental stores, but where you could actually rent a 16 millimeter projector and several prints for a few dozen rand South African money, and you would take the projector home with the prints, and you would project them at home, and then you would bring the projector and the prints back. It's kind of amazing what people had to go through to actually see film or TV. They were so hungry to see these images because I think it was state-controlled TV, and it offered very, very little for the average viewer. So they were desperate to see anything they could, any kind of entertainment.
So we were selling things like Mod Squad, Mission Impossible, Mannix, shows from the 60s that by the 70s were in syndication, action-type shows mostly.
Mm-hmm.
But we were getting an awful lot of money for shows that in the States would maybe sell for $10 or $15. They would sell for a couple hundred dollars in South Africa. So for a while, it was a great deal until it wasn't anymore, of course.
And now, of course, what's funny is that it's normal nowadays that even if people can see them, it's not unusual to find pirated versions of current movies and television shows because it's become a very easy thing to do. And even though there are people who get caught, there's still quite a bit of people doing it. Most of the time, hopefully, they're not charging, but you never know. But, I mean, it's
well, bear in mind, copying video is much easier
right.
than copying. Oh, copying film, you need a film lab. You need stock. You need chemicals. You need people who know what they're doing. And you need a place to do it, and it's not necessarily simple, easy, or cheap. Copying video, you just need two machines. You push play and record when all said and done.
So then going from that initial story in the early 70s, and you've already brought it, you already mentioned it, Dennis, but the major crackdown that happened in the mid-70s, as you pointed out, that particularly affected Roddy McDowall, who, if people don't know him, he had a number of major roles, but probably the one that most people know him about, of course they never even saw his face, was in Planet of the Apes and some of the sequels where he appeared as one of the younger apes. And Roddy McDowall is somebody who had his own film library. And not only was he arrested and had his film library seized, but what happened when he was questioned by the authorities?
Well, he was under tremendous pressure, and I think you have to put yourself in Roddy McDowall's shoes. He was being charged as a film pirate. Well, not only did he have film prints, but he was also recording movies off of television. And so this was at the very dawn of video technology. And I think that probably put the fear of God into the MPAA as well as the notion that he was recording things off of TV. As you pointed out, when the first Betamax recorders came out, the studios actually sued to make them playback only. They didn't want people being able to record shows like Seinfeld or Cheers off of TV. And it was a landmark case that actually went to the Supreme Court and established the legal definition of time shifting, or we would now call it TiVoing, which is basically that it's legally permissible for you to record something at home to view it at a more convenient time. But the major studios, the networks, had sued to prevent private individuals from doing that and electronics company from even making video recorders that would do that. So Roddy was not only collecting his own films, but he was recording things off of TV in the early 70s. And under enormous pressure from the government, he rolled over and named other collectors, including Rock Hudson, Mel Torme, and Dick Martin of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In fame. And he's gotten a lot of flack for it over the years that he essentially ratted out other collectors. And I think that may be a harsh judgment. I mean, McDowell gave an enormous amount to his profession. He obviously loved films and film history. And honestly, if I were in his position, I'm not sure what I would have done, you know, in his shoes. But apparently he stopped collecting films. He used to have regular screenings for other collectors and enthusiasts at his home, and he stopped doing those altogether. And I mean, it's very sad. You know, you can still go online and Google his name and film collecting, and people will, you know, refer to him as a fink for ratting out other collectors, which is sad that's part of his legacy. You know, we talked to Bob Osborne of Turner Classic Movies fame, who was friends with both Roddy McDowell and with Rock Hudson, and he told us some great stories that Hudson had a private film collection as well, but it was almost entirely his own movies. Mm-hmm. So he had prints of Giant, and he had prints of Pillow Talk, and only movies that he had starred in. And Bob Osborne, when he was young and a diehard film fan, he helped organize Hudson's collection, and he wrote the names of all the films and kind of decorated the cans so they were easy for him to find. He said that in the early 70s, when word started to spread through the collector subculture that the FBI and the Justice Department were targeting collectors, that Hudson had a fake brick wall built to disguise the entrance to his film vault. So when the feds came calling, he said, "I don't have any films," and they couldn't find it. So the irony is that pretty much every collector who was active in the 1970s that we spoke with was contacted at some point by the FBI. We were doing a book signing last week, and a guy who was in his late 50s or early 60s came up to buy a copy of the book, and he said, "Oh, yeah, you know, I used to be a collector myself, and I was active in this period." And I said, "Were you contacted by the FBI?" He goes, "Yeah, I was." So everybody, and that's one of the things that makes this subculture so remarkable, is for that brief, very, very frantic period in the early to mid-late 1970s, they were so heavily targeted by the FBI and the Justice Department. And it created a culture of secrecy and paranoia that lasts to this day. I mean, there are still collectors that essentially live behind unmarked doors. One of the guys we interviewed for the book, his apartment has an unmarked door. There's no number on it. It's right by the laundry room in his building. And if you don't know that he lives there, you wouldn't know that was actually the entrance to an apartment. And it's because he's paranoid about the feds coming someday to take his film collection. You know, the other thing is that a number of the collectors were also gay men, and they were of that generation where, you know, they were being regularly harassed or intimidated. Then you add to that, the FBI comes banging on your door one day asking where you got your film prints and shoving documents at you and trying to seize your films. It's no wonder these guys were paranoid, and still are.
Right. And yet, in some cases, some of the examples you gave in the book, some of these folks actually did a benefit to the film industry, because they sometimes were finding prints or sections of prints of films that everybody thought had been lost. And yet, sometimes they were able to find some of the missing footage, and you mentioned the one example I can remember off the top of my head is King Kong. And obviously there were all kinds of discussions about scenes from that movie over time. And a collector actually found some of the lost footage. And there are films today that are probably being shown on video, you know, in video format, that include footage that was found by a collector.
Not just footage, but soundtracks as well. A lot of the studios weren't very careful with their stereo soundtracks in the 50s because the stock was so expensive they would erase it and reuse it and didn't keep copies of anything. So there's dozens of feature films from Fox, Warners, and other studios where they no longer had the stereophonic soundtracks, but collectors did. And so they managed to loan them to the studios over the years, and quite a few of those now exist because collectors have the prints.
Well, one of the most fascinating collectors slash distributors that we talked to was Mike Vraney of Something Weird Video, who sadly passed away a few months after we interviewed him. Nobody knew that he was sick and fighting cancer at the time we talked with him. But he had devoted most of his adult life to ferreting out grindhouse and sexploitation movies from the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s, what we would call softcore movies, but in, you know, in all these different sort of subterranean subgenres like White Coders and Nudie Cuties and Nudie Ruffies. These were movies that were so far off the radar screen for most film buffs that, you know, they didn't even know that they had ever existed, let alone were in danger of being lost. So, you know, a lot of people would have said, well, this is just trash, but to Mike, these movies were gems. They were, you know, somebody had gone out, they had made them, they had acted in them, they had directed them, starred in them, and he wanted to preserve them at all costs. And he talked about this surreptitious discovery. A friend of his said, hey, you know, there's this antique store in Washington, and in the back room, it's stuffed from floor to ceiling with film negatives. And he went there, and what it was were original 35mm negatives to these kind of soft core girly loops that were made in the 1930s and 1940s that were completely lost. And there were hundreds and hundreds of these. And he bought the entire back room for $200 and loaded up his van, and then spent the next 10 or 20 years, he released them first on VHS video and then on DVD. So you could argue about, you know, how much cultural value they have, but they were films. They were part of American culture, even if they were sexploitation. And Mike devoted himself to making sure that they were preserved. And I think he was proud of that, and rightly so, especially because it was an area, I guess you would say, a kind of sleazy, dark corner of you know, film culture that nobody else was really paying attention to. You know, it's a lot of the classics or art house movies that would get the lion's share of attention from archives or restorationists, but how many people are going to go out there and, you know, restore Olga's House of Shame or some of the movies that Mike was responsible for preserving? So I'm really happy that we were able to get his story in the book while he was still around to tell it.
And then, of course, some of the people you talked to, and we already mentioned Leonard Maltin, are famous people, for lack of a better way to put it. I mean, we've talked about Leonard Maltin and we talked about Roddy McDowall, but one of the people you interviewed was Joe Dante, the director. And it turns out he is or was a collector as well.
Oh, he Joe still is.
Yeah, no, Joe is incredibly active and incredibly generous with loaning prints. He actually has a unique three-way collection, which he put together with John Davison, who is a lifelong friend of his. They worked together first in the late 60s on an underground compilation called The Movie Orgy that used to be distributed to kind of midnight movies and film campuses, and then later they worked on Hollywood Boulevard and Piranha. And John went on to produce films like RoboCop and Starship Troopers and the Airplane movies. And then a director named Tim Hunter, who did The River's Edge, a number of other great art house films. So the three of them decided to team up, and essentially whatever prints they would buy would go into this kind of three-way collection, much of which is now on deposit here in L.A. with the Academy Film Archive. And we screened, you know, some amazingly rare prints over the years from Joe's collection. The one event that I talk about in the book that really jumps out is an amazing early 1960s apocalyptic sci-fi film directed by Val Guest called The Day the Earth Caught Fire. And it's very hard to find original 35mm prints of the film. And Joe and John and Tim happened to have one. And we screened it once a few years ago, and the director of the film, Val Guest, was still alive. And at the end of the show, the entire audience of about 350 people jumped to their feet and spontaneously burst into applause. And Val, I was there with him, sitting beside him, and he literally burst into tears. He was so moved, and they were applauding just because the film was so moving. They thought it was so damned good that they, and it was one of the few times that I ever saw an audience do that, that they just had to jump to their feet and start applauding because they were so surprised and moved by seeing this film. And that wouldn't have happened if Joe had not bought and preserved that print and then freely loaned it for that screening. So Joe and John and Tim are, I think, one of the finest examples of people in the industry. They make films themselves, but who feel a sense of obligation to make prints of films. These aren't their own films necessarily.
Right.
For other directors, other artists, to make them freely available. And there's a great quote from Joe. You know, he said that when he and John first started out, and they would do all sorts of crazy things to get their hands on prints, because we always operated under the assumption that nobody cared about these prints but us. And he said, and you know what? We were right. And I think that's the truth. Collectors did care, you know, obsessively, you know, maybe, you know, wildly and over the top. But if it wasn't for a lot of those collectors out there, they wouldn't have preserved a lot of material that have otherwise would have disappeared.
Well, and I know growing up myself, I used to read the, the Famous Monsters of Filmland and those magazines, and they would mention films. And of course, as you've pointed out, the only way you could see them would be if they showed up on midnight movies or happened to be shown in a theater as part of some sort of a special event. But chances were good you were never going to see them. And yet those are the kind of films in many ways we're talking about. These aren't the ones that necessarily the studios cared so much about that they cared for them lovingly and made sure they were still in great shape and all that.
But even those movies, you know, there were collectors who would run Gone with the Wind for their friends and family, because even Gone with the Wind you couldn't see unless it was in release, or, you know, in those days it wasn't on television, so unless it was in release, you didn't see Gone with the Wind. Now,
right.
Of course, nobody would show up for a screening like that, because anybody could see Gone with the Wind in their own.
Well, the funny part about it is I do have these occasional, some of the movie theaters will show classic movies, but on the big screen, and they get a certain amount of interest. People will come to see them because of being able to see them that way. But you're right. I mean, the average person, I'm sure, has absolutely no interest in seeing them that way anymore. Although, like I say, I still remember going to see Gone with the Wind in the theater because, as you pointed out, it was the only way to see it.
Well, Jeff was responsible for finding and identifying and preserving a lot of unique, one-of-a-kind materials. You know, Jeff, maybe you can talk about the original Citizen Kane trailer and about the final footage for Greta Garbo.
Oh, well, you know, Greta Garbo, I guess it was 1949, she was going to make a comeback, and so they did some costume makeup tests that she paid for. And she didn't like the way she looked in them, so she ordered them destroyed, and the project never got made. And I had read in various books that this footage had been shot, but it had been listed as lost footage for years and years. And we found two of the three reels, then we found the third reel, so those have all been preserved. They're now at UCLA. But for years, those did not exist until we found them, and we dug, two of the three reels came out of the trash can, actually. We dug those out of a trash receptacle.
Mm-hmm.
That was an excellent find, I have to say. What was the other thing you asked about, Dennis?
Oh, the original Citizen Kane trailer.
Oh, right, the Citizen Kane trailer. When, what happened, a lot of the studios over the years, when they would reissue a movie, they would recut the trailer for reissue, but they didn't save the original version. And for example, Wizard of Oz is that way. The original trailer for Wizard of Oz does not exist, or Robin Hood's another one. The Adventures of Robin Hood, the original trailer doesn't exist. But Citizen Kane, that happened with, and at some point someone did find an original 35mm nitrate copy of the trailer. They loaned it to Turner, and so all the elements that exist on that are from that original 35mm, which I later acquired for $500, the most I ever paid for a trailer because of what it was. And it's now part of the at UCLA. They do have it now.
So I'll ask each of you, although you tended, you know, the book was done together. What was your biggest surprise? What really got you in your interviews of the people you talked to, of what they found?
I think for me, I can say talking to people like Al Beardsley and having them be honest and saying the various horrible things they did over the years on the record. That was a surprise. Dennis?
For me, the biggest surprise, I think, was hearing the personal stories of the collectors, not even related to their love of the movies, but, you know, where they grew up, about their families, their mothers, their fathers, their brothers and sisters, you know. And then they would talk about, you know, one of the collectors, Mark Punswick, talked about cutting a hole in the wall of his parents' living room so that he could make a little projection booth window, and he put his projector on the other side of it. So, you know, there were all these great little, you know, very human and revealing stories about, you know, the lives of these men. And it was an almost entirely male subculture. It was very, very homogeneous. It was mostly white male from middle class families, because film collecting was an expensive hobby. It was. Even back in the 60s and 70s, you know, you could pay anywhere from $50 to $150 or $200 on the high end for, you know, a desirable 16mm film. And then when Jeff got back into dealing in the late 80s, early 90s, he used to joke that he added a zero to the cost of films, which isn't far from the truth. Prices really escalated, especially for 35mm film in the 90s and early 2000s, before the kind of bottom fell out of the market. For many years, 16mm was by far the most sought after and most common format for collectors, because it was very easy to project. You know, it's like you could have a 16mm projector like you used to see in AV departments in high school,
right,
and just put that on your dining room table or kitchen table and put up a little portable screen. If you wanted to project 35mm, that was a professional format. You needed to have two projectors to do changeovers. You needed to have kind of a home theater set up. You needed to have a lot of technical expertise and money. So 35mm collecting was the exception and not the norm for most of the life of the subculture. It wasn't until really the 90s when a lot of people became more interested in 35mm, because it was, you know, much higher resolution. But, you know, even at the height of the market, the most that anybody would pay for a print, and Jeff, you know, you can address this because that was your bread and butter, would be what, like $7,500 to $10,000 maybe, for what were like the rarest prints you ever
sold?
Well,
I mean, the rarest films I ever sold were mid Technicolor prints and 35mm, Singing in the Rain and Bandwagon, for $7,000 a pop, but that was to somebody who had money, and most collectors did not really have that kind of money to do that sort of thing. I would say the high end titles, maybe $5,000, a little bit more than that, but nowadays, not. I mean, I would be surprised if anything would sell for that kind of money anymore.
Well, so how long did this project take you from when you first decided you were going to write this book? I mean, obviously, it's been your life's work, especially Jeff, but how long from the moment you said, okay, I think there's a book here, till the day you finally finished it and sent it off to the publisher? How long did
about
the whole
4 years, would you say, Dennis?
Well, Jeff had actually been working on it long before he and I started talking about it, with his late wife, Florin Jones-Joseph. They had actually amassed a tremendous amount of research into the subject of film collecting, film piracy, which we drew on. So there were a lot of fantastic, you know, articles from the trade papers and different magazines. But it was really about 4 years from when Jeff and I, and I think it was prompted by the fact that we saw the subculture vanishing so quickly. So we interviewed well over 100 former and current collectors and dealers, and then we narrowed that down to about 25 who are profiled in chapters in the book. There are several included in the projectionist chapter. And, you know, the hardest thing for us was actually deciding what to include and what to leave out, because there were some amazing and compelling collector stories. But at a certain point, we also realized that there were, you know, some of them would overlap if they collected classic Hollywood films or musicals or science fiction movies. And so we wanted to show a really wide range, which is why, you know, we have Mike Rainey's chapter about sexploitation, of Mike Hyatt's chapter on his over 30-year quest to preserve and restore a single film, which is the early 1960s sci-fi classic, The Day of the Triffids, which is this sort of wonderful, mad, heroic one-man quest to save this one movie at all costs, which in many ways has come to define his adult career and his life, is his passion for this one film.
And it's still not finished.
Yes, and it's still, and Mike is still working on it. I don't think it'll ever be finished with the Day of the Triffids. So it was really hard for us. Our first draft of the book, I kid you not, was about 700 pages because we just wanted everything to be in there. And we sent it to a few publishers and they said, yeah, you know, this is a fascinating subject matter, but nobody's going to read a 700-page book. So we really had to go back to the drawing board, kind of start over, really cut it down. And a mutual friend of ours, Sylvia Townsend, put us in touch with the University Press of Mississippi. And normally they'll get a proposal or maybe a sample chapter on a book. And we said, well, you know, we can send you the finished manuscript. And they read it very quickly and they said, yeah, we love it. This is a subject that nobody has covered before. Honestly, if we started now, I don't know that we would be able to do justice to the book or to the subculture, because some of the really key players like Ken Kramer, Jeff's one-time partner and longtime friend, have passed away. And without those stories, you know, you're not getting the heart and soul of what made collectors, you know, sacrifice everything. Tony Tirano, the one-legged former Broadway gypsy, who we profile in one of the most heartbreaking chapters in the book, who sadly has also passed away, said that he would often go without eating. He would give up dinner so that he would have enough money to buy a particular print. And he said that's part of the illness of collecting. And there was a lot of illness, to be honest. You know, some of these guys would easily qualify as hoarders. We would go into, you know, houses or apartments where there's huge teetering stacks of vinegar-smelling film prints and dusty projectors that hadn't been used in decades and yellowed newspapers and press books and, you know, teetering stacks that if there were a tremor would, you know, bury the owner of all this stuff. So there was definitely a hoarding impulse with a lot of these collectors. You know, again, you know, that we wanted to do justice to that as well. You know, we tried to be as honest and fair as we could with the book, both the positive side of the subculture and also the negative side.
Well, I, for one, am thankful for University Presses. They, these days especially, it's just unbelievable some of the books that they have published that help to better explain the film. You know, like I said, a number of the authors I talked to wrote their books for University Presses, and it's just unbelievable how much is out there these days of really great books, and there's no question in my mind that yours is definitely on that list, and so I really am glad that I came across it, and I'm really glad that I got a chance to talk to both of you. I hope the book continues to do well for you, and I hope that the collectors out there that still remain find some solace and comfort in what you wrote. So thank you, Dennis.
Joel, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
And thank you, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Joel. Really appreciate it.
Hopefully you found this topic to be as fascinating as I did. Thanks to Dennis and Jeff for sharing their experiences. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more new books in film.